Okay, now it's time for our man versus machine competition. George Blood is the owner of Safe Sound Archive, a vendor providing audio and video preservation services to our community. He is active on various standards committees, the Ars Technical Committee, the National Recording Preservation Board's Advisory Board for the National Preservation Plan, and he frequently presents at conferences and offers workshops. Let's welcome George Blood.
Toby provided me with a great hook there about saying that his workflow wasn't perfect. And having been at this preservation stuff longer than Toby, I can tell you that your workflow will neither be perfect nor ever stop evolving. Even the grand work that's being done out at Culpeper on workflows and the work that CubeTech has done, it's not that CubeTech has another version of their software to sell you. It's that the technology continues to evolve. I stumbled a couple of months ago upon an interesting fact doing some analysis for my bank that in the last 10 years, my staff has doubled and our output has increased by eightfold, that the impact of work of looking at your workflow continuously, always accepting that there's something that can be better, that you can do things simpler and faster, it really has a huge impact over time. And the presentation I'm going to make is in some of the more obvious areas of where you can push the envelope to simplify the process, yet work at a much higher level of accuracy and certainty. Now, I think the battle of man versus machine must go back as far as stone tools, but presenting the argument is a struggle between brawn and brains really misses the point, because machines relieve drudgery and effort, and anybody who does any one thing all day long, and whatever it is, will find that there's a great deal of drudgery involved, however much or however interesting the content may be. But there are some things that computers are ever likely to replace or to do for us, such as emotional and sensory pleasures. And I would just as soon enjoy recorded sound myself, thank you very much. Or to ponder the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. At every mechanical development, one side argues the old way of doing things is better, and the other side argues the new way is better. There's the loss of artisan craft versus the consistency and lower price of priced goods, vine-ripened tomatoes versus machine harvestable fruit. But all of this misses the more fundamental point. There are some things for which humans are better suited than machines, and there are some things for which machines are better suited than humans. For instance, I can say with a great deal of certainty that no carbon-based life form will ever generate a checksum on a sound file, quite simply because no one would live that long. So, we know that there are some things that we depend upon computers for. No silicon-based intelligence is ever going to undo a mess like this. And if it would, by the time that problem is solved, we probably won't be using silicon in computers anyway. But let's take a simple example where there's pretty much universal agreement on where we let computers. And that's rekeying. Computers rekey much better than humans. Rather than typing a text of strings, the human has a few simple, highly repetitive, that is, unchanging and quickly familiar steps. But, because even with very simple words and textual elements, this will be more accurate than rekeying every letter. Complicated or unfamiliar key combinations are highly prone to error. We'll take this even a little further. How many of us know the complete set of illegal characters and would recognize them in all their different situations? Who can remember the different illegal character sets for file naming versus path names versus XML versus operating systems and so on? Did you know that there are three different characters in Unicode that we would generically call the apostrophe? They are the vertical glyph, the left curly quote, and the right curly quote. Only the vertical glyph has an ASCII equivalent. The two others yield gibberish in Unicode if it's interpreted by ASCII, and this is true with a lot of diacritic marks. So let's dream here a little bit. How then can we ask the computer a good question? What do we want the computer to do? We'd want to build a machine, or at least some code, that would take a string of text, check it for illegal characters, treat according to defined rules, which is to say if you have different illegal characters, you treat them in different ways, so that if somebody puts a hard carriage return in a file name, you just want to remove that. But if they have a U with an umlaut, you would map that to UE. And then we would check that there's a crosswalk between Unicode and ASCII, and then we would paste that text. And now for extra credit, you would build a map that would eliminate even the act of copy and pasting, because you can always copy and paste in the wrong place. We want the computer to handle that for us. And for extra credit, you would have defined sets of rules that would not allow putting the wrong data in a field, so that you couldn't put, identification information in the date field. And there are a couple of solutions to this. Audiovisual Preservation Solutions has a tool that they developed that has, it's rules-based on the structure of what they call an input conformance document and validates the rules of entry. Their tool does have a nice batch processor, but it doesn't do the text cleaning. Dobbin is a batch processor that asserts according to configurable rules. It doesn't do the text cleaning, but it works in an environment that does a lot of other things as well. Our homebrew solution, and there are others, BMS Chase has one, the Harvard Toolkit is from Sound Directions has a variety of tools as well. We do the text cleaning, we have flexible insertion rules, we don't validate the rules of entry, we don't, really don't have a batch process, you know, but it's what it fits into our ever-evolving workflow. Maybe one day we'll have a batch processor. But let's now look at the reverse. This is clearly something that a computer will do much better than any human. But let's look at the reverse. How about reading the metadata, the file names and related metadata, and testing to see whether you've gotten back what you wanted, that nothing's gone wrong. Everything is as intended. And there are two key parts to this kind of work. First and foremost, you need a second set of tools that is aware of the textual elements. You know, it's nice to be in an environment where we will all standardize on one tool, and we'll say, we're going to use WaveLab, or only WaveLab, or SoundForge, or any tool. But of course, if I do the insertion of this metadata and Mike opens it up on his copy of WaveLab, it'll say that it's right. We would expect this. What we want to do is open it up on another platform and see how that goes. And there's a when's Chris's presentation? Is that this afternoon? Right after lunch. There's an analysis that the technical committee put together. Chris Lysinek shepherded, looking at a variety of different software tools and how they handle the metadata for interoperability. Luckily for us, Jove will read the textual elements in broadcast WAV files, and it's widely adopted and trusted. All that's needed to complete the picture is a way to check the copy and paste map and compare the text. And there are plenty of tools that can do this kind of binary match. Excel, C++, Visual Basic all have commands like this, and they're readily available. But there are also more sophisticated tools. This is the one that we use, DiffMerge. It's available at SoundGear. And the tool that we built, I know you're not going to be able to read this, but conceptually you can see it's reading the field headers, showing the text. And if you look at the bottom, there's a gray bar across. Our programmer built this to call out what the difference is and then highlights in red what's sort of like the grammar and spelling checker in Word. But why don't we just fail this? Why don't we just say it doesn't match? Well, it's nice that it actually tells you where to go, but why wouldn't we just fail this and go back? Is because one of the things that computers don't do, although the computer will go through and check every single letter of this really fast and much more accurately than a human will, why don't we just pass this? Was one of the things that humans don't, that computers don't do very well, is exercise discretionary judgment. At some point, the human needs to take over and look at why there is a difference. Now, in this particular example, that's a change in the coding history, that it makes perfect sense that the information on the left is what got sent to the file, and then the software that's operating on the file declares itself according to the rules of the broadcast wave file and adds another line. So by definition, it won't match. And if you put it on the left-hand side, if the tool operates properly, it would just repeat it at the end. Does the difference matter? So, you know, is it within tolerance? A lot of desktop tools don't read time, for instance, exactly the same way. If they're slamming our hands in the drawer, we defined that if the time specification was within 3 seconds, that was accurate enough for a metadata entry. It's not accurate enough for mixing or sound file matching, but for general use, 3 seconds works. And most importantly, we want feedback from the systems that tell us that, you know, if you're seeing the same error over and over again, you shouldn't be exercising judgment over that. You should try to do something about it. You want this information presented to you to interact with. So we have a system where the computer checks the text really fast and really accurately, and then human comes in and makes judgments as to whether it's really a problem or not. This is the paper I gave 2 years. It's from the paper I gave 2 years ago about the problem of output of an analog to digital converter and whether and how it makes it into a file. And Chris Lesinik at Audiovisual Preservation Solutions has published a paper that's on their website. There's the URL. And there's findings on this same topic. So I'm going to not repeat that part of the presentation, but we're looking to build a tool. We have a specification. We've run some alpha tests on this. The process of doing the null test takes us about 15 or 20 minutes, but the alpha version of this tool that checks for both time-based and amplitude-based errors will run in about 2 minutes, including downloading the files to the computer, running the test. For a one-hour file, we'll go through and do a bit accurate test and report back where and the nature of the problems. This is clearly, although humans can do this and humans can look at it and interact it and make judgment calls on it, the computer will be much faster for this sort of QA. This is perhaps the biggest question that we hear in our world is, we've got this massive collection, where do we begin? There's a very lively conversation at EMEA last year where somebody declared that we as collections managers, as curators, are abdicating our responsibilities to make the hard choices about where do we begin, what's going to get saved, and due to the passage of time and inadequate resources, what's not going to get saved. And then somebody else got up and said, wait a minute, we know this isn't true. Due to the long tail and the internet, we know that we cannot know ahead of time and judge what it is that users will actually be interested in. So how then do we decide? Where do we begin? What parameters are there that we would put on this? And from this dilemma is born the survey tools. The survey tools are an effort by intelligent and well-meaning preservation professionals to turn the art of selection into a hard science. And the goal is to collect hard data, either a small core set of data points or in a larger comprehensive set of data points, such as obsolescence factors, deterioration, intellectual value, uniqueness, and the list goes on and on and on. And then perhaps give some discretionary judgment to the user to put more weight on some of the elements other than others. And in a lot of the tools, they'll give you a numerical value at the end. the weight priorities and give you a place of where to begin, or at least help figure it out. Unfortunately, it doesn't work, and it can't work, and I'm going to show you why. Because at the end of collecting a lot of data, the frustrations likely to result, the mathematics tells us that more examples we collect, the more likely any of them are to be average. As your sample set grows, if you chart the results, you're more likely to get the classic Gaussian distribution and the familiar bell curve. Indeed, according to the law of large numbers, the more data points you collect, the more certain and unclear, or the more certain and clearer the bell shape becomes. Yes, I'm going to take you through this. Okay. Both the weak and strong version of the law of large numbers state with virtual certainty that the sample average, and that is just the statement of average, if you look at that, it's the values x to n divided by n, the number of values. You know, the difference between the weak and strong versions is whether you accept that there is an infinite number of data points and an infinite variable, or if the number of variables is constrained. Constrained is the weak version, and the strong is the infinite. You can prove both. And this is this. That's the as n approaches infinity. An assumption of the finite variance is not necessary, right? You don't have to say that we're going to constrain this. It's also true for an infinite number. This is the large or infinite variance will make the convergence slower. So as you collect more data points, it takes longer for the curve to appear. But sooner or later, here it comes. All right. Or to put it more simply, this is what happens. All right. Okay. By the central limit theorem, this is 11th, 12th grade, you know, end of algebra 2, maybe beginning of calculus. Under certain conditions, the number of random variables with finite means being sort of like an average rather than I only have so much money, of finite means and variance, and there's only some, you're putting a value, 1 to 5, 1 to 10, 1 to 3, there's a finite variance. The normal distribution as the number of approaches the bell curve as the number of variances increases. For this reason, the normal distribution is commonly encountered in practice. When you do this, this is what happens. And a large or infinite variance will make the convergence slower, but the law of large number holds anyway. All right. Now, if the end of your high school years are a little fuzzy, we'll go back a little earlier. We'll go back to the beginning of Algebra 2, 7th, 8th grade maybe. And we'll revisit our friend, the quadratic equation. And in this case, the function of x would be that great big long formula that I showed you and we moved on really fast from. That gives us e raised to the quadratic equation, wherein a is the width of our bell curve, b is its position on the x-axis, c is its height. Or to put it another way, you can change the shape of the curve by changing the weighting of your data elements, the number of things that you collect, and the way in which you, the variance, you know, 1 to 5, 1 to 3, 1 to 10. But in the end, you end up with 10% of your materials being really important in really bad condition in really obsolete formats. 10% of the stuff, you have no idea why anybody kept this, but it's in really great shape on common formats, and you know, you wish it would just go away. But that 80% of the material sits under the curve, and it's all average. Now, if you really are struggling to believe all this, we can sit down over lunch on my laptop, and we can crunch some more numbers, or we can just keep our lunch down. But this, I think, misses the point that there is value in survey tools. But the value in survey tools isn't that it will make the decision for you, but that it gives you information that you can act upon. Principally, you end up with item-level data. Now, I'm going to jump ahead of thought a little bit because it helps carry through this. If you want your survey tool to generate a magic number, I can go back and show you that formula, and you're going to fail. It's not going to work. If you want your survey tool to do something, decide ahead of time what you want it to do. I'm going to ask it these questions. All right? I want to know these things. So you collect that data. Working from a survey tool which you haven't pre-prepared the data is very difficult. So you have a bunch of data, and then you have to make up questions for it, but you haven't decided what that question is going to be. It's rather like, all right, you could asking where do we begin is like asking the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. The answer you get is 42. Sorry. Okay. The problem isn't with the answer. The problem is with the question. So we're going to take an actual example. AVDB is the survey tool that was developed at Columbia that Marcos Sueros surveyed 50,000 items at the object level. So you have this body of data, very large body of data, that Janet Gertz, the head of preservation and digitization at Columbia, wanted to put together a grant project. It says, what can I get out of this data? She asked it a couple of questions. She wanted oral histories. The reason she wanted oral histories is because Columbia has a high level of bibliographic control. It's like that wasn't going to be a problem with these materials. History proved otherwise, but you know, this was they had a good sense of that wasn't going to be a big part of the project. Then she looked at She reasoned that if Columbia were to ever have a digitization facility on campus, and real estate being what it is and it being New York, she figured they would never really have a digitization studio. But even if they did, there would be some things that would need to go to specialists. So she wanted to take everything that was in really bad condition, thank you very much, and send it out. And then, with the way that the data was collected, she was able to associate all of those things which were in really bad condition with other objects in that intellectual grouping. So that if this tape was bad, but it was part of an 8-tape interview, she would be able to grab the other 7 tapes as well. So that she would not just process the problematic material, but everything related to it. So that at the end of the day, the interview would be complete. So this was a rather interactive process because she knew about how large a set she would be able to work with based on the budget, but she wouldn't be able to know that ahead of time. She did multiple sorts. She just kept asking questions of the data, and she had the object level data that was able to provide that to her. So she also went through and said she wanted cassettes and reels, but did not want DATs or mini disks for reasons that were associated with building the metadata for this. So she wanted to constrain the set in some other way to build a large enough data set but constrain its parameters so that it would be easy to get her head around. So at the end of the day, the issue isn't man versus machine. There are some things for which humans are ideally suited and other things which humans need to be ready to let go of. And the more you can do that, the more work that you'll get done. But if you also keep in touch with and interact with that data, you find that it's a real collaboration between man versus machine, or man and machine rather than man versus machine, as it were. I can't leave this up long because I didn't get permission for this picture. So I hope this is as a bright of, with the clouds parted and we got some sunshine at the end of these thoughts. Questions? The central theorem of limits, anybody? Yes?
Do you care to offer any insight at all into the idea, because you set up as sort of universal machine, just with survey tools, particularly the fact that possibly you can't quantify qualities, and that the human not only is better at deciding why an error in comparing files might be valuable, but why making selection criteria on a collection just saying, do you want to make a case for sleeping around?
Here, let's go back to the slide.
But on an intellectual level, not a mathematical one.
No, I'm going before those slides. I'm going to your earlier part. Let's at this example. One of the things that has made that has happened as a result of the development of this is the people who are doing QA are presented with the textual elements fast, and it tells what it is. So they've got the file open, and the file is playing. And they can do something that the computer really can't do, which was to know whether file's playing backwards, whether it's George Blood or Vinnie Pelote speaking, whether there's somebody else suddenly appears, the content changes. These are all things that are really hard for computers to do. And this kind of work, leaning on the computer, leaves the carbon-based life form able to keep its brain focused on the things that it does best. So by collaborating in that way, we're able to do both layers of QA at the same time. Yes, but I only appear on one interview.
Okay.
You know, this is the constantly evolving thing. It says, wait a minute, why is there music on this interview? Does it belong there? Well, you know, there are lots and lots of examples where the humans are just going to be able to make that judgment. Or separate from that, you can train the computer to recognize my voice, but if the file name is any one of these, it's not going to be able to make the association. Steve?
Just talk about the workflow, which seems to be the core issue here.
Mm-hmm.
In dividing out what is being chosen by the institution to send out, and subsequently by the studio performing the work, there's an issue as to what is comfortable for machine-only work. Physically, this tape will work on a machine, doesn't need a whole lot of supervision. This needs to go onto a new reel, it's got a crack in it. This one needs to be taken apart because the middle is falling out of the hub, and so forth and so on. And that's something that you, as the person operating the studio, will know and can do, not triage. Well, maybe in this case it's triage because there's three types. And one would go to one facility or person, one would go to another desk or bench, and the third to yet another. But the person actually dividing this out at the institutional level may not have enough foreknowledge of the materials themselves and the processes that are necessary to get them through the preservation process to know that this is going to cause, this looks okay, but it's really going to be real expensive to do. So is this an educational issue as well between the studio and the people doing the dividing up of the materials and creating budgets which determine how much of their work you can actually.
I would couch that answer in the context of a different conversation, and that's harking back to Adam Smith and the Pin Factory, that by dividing the work up into different stations and giving people, the individuals, less to concern themselves with, they develop a greater level of expertise. And so it's very difficult for a lot of people managing collections because they're not AV specialists generally. They're, you know, as Alan Lewis politely calls it, they're paper trained. And so when they're faced with the audio materials, they're not going to be able to make the judgments that we as specialists can. I generally find that they have a very much lower threshold about what is scary than we would, rather than they keep hold something back thinking it's going to be easy and they're wrong. But that applies at every step along the way. Selection, description, you know, whatever the strengths that you and I have have or may not have as audio engineers, I know for one, I'm a really terrible MARC cataloger. And similarly, I've got people who have an amazing temperament to sit and do QA all day long. I can't sit still that long enough to do that kind of work. And we have further divided out so that we've got people who specialize in discs and people who do cassettes, and all the burning of CDs and any of that work is handled by a completely different department, so that you have that level of specialization. And the notion that it makes most sense for one person to pull the tape off the shelf or disc or whatever it is and work with it until all the metadata is inserted, embedded in the files, external, create all the derivatives, file them in all the different places, and check that the work is right, I think is a really broken model. And it doesn't scale very well because, you know, there's not linear relationships between how long it takes to do each step.
It is a matter of scales because it's a matter of the number of employees. If you're working with one or two people, it's a different matter than if you're working with a factory.
Oh, yeah, the scale does matter, and there are enormous economies of scale as you do larger and larger amounts of material. But even the division of labor between the people who are making the selections, triaging what's bad and needs to go, or deciding what's important, and when it gets to the engineer, there is a division of labor there already.
Yeah, having 50 people doing all the same thing doesn't make sense.
Exactly. If you have 50 people, you're going to get much higher output by having each of them specialize in different things.
Provided you have enough of the same thing.
No. It doesn't have to. I mean, just you could just have 10 people who do video and 10 people who do cassettes and 5 people who do discs.
I don't speak of it in that sense. I'm speaking of it in terms of the specific ills of the object that you're dealing with. This is spilled tape. This tape is wound backwards.
That's the emergency bell.
What stopped?
Sorry, Joe.
Do you have a question?
Yeah. We did a project where the result was 15,000 digital files, and the first level of decision making was a contract review. So that's a human emotion fear. We're afraid we didn't digitize anything that we were digitizing a body that had already migrated once. So we didn't digitize what we thought we probably shouldn't have had in the first place, although we still have it. The idea was not to compound the risk by digitizing something that we probably. So it was risk. We're afraid, it was fear. We're afraid of being sued, so we did what we knew was legally owned, and we digitized that. So, in that sense, the danger to the materials wasn't second to not wanting the university to be sued.
Oh, which raises another issue of the sequence in which the work is performed. It's like, do you do a copyright analysis before you begin the processing, or afterward when you can be sure, when you can be clear on what the content is?
First, and then after.
How are we doing for time? Okay, we got time for more, or we can give more time to Rob. Oh,
this is your chance, buddy. You had two parts to this discussion. You started with saying that people that are too specialized get bored, and at the end you're saying that you have 50 people that you want to have more specialization. There's a crossover point between the two, and the boredom point is somewhere in the middle, and the boredom point leads to errors. So where do you find that crossover point?
Well, one of the things that we're able to do with the volume of material that we're processing is I like to see my employees arguing over who gets to do which collection, you know, so that there's some engagement in it. And at the other extreme is, look, they call it work for a reason.
It's not the point of work, it's the point of doing the same thing repetitively all day when you start making mistakes.
I think this question of scale in the projects. Simple things like, I really want my employees to leave the facility for lunch, just for that head time. We also rotate between projects. And I think it's that point at which the tedium comes in varies from individual to individual. Personally, I couldn't work on the same project for 2 years, and I've had people just thrive at this environment because they get to hear every single one of these objects, and they really become very intimate with the materials. And so it's, and I have some engineers who can spin on a dime and change through three projects in a day, and other ones who are fine leaving for long stretches. And so we target the nature of the jobs, materials, duration, complexity to different personal temperaments and experiences. Andy.
Can we get to refer to you as the Henry Ford of
audio? Well, remember, Henry Ford also sent his engineers out into junkyards to find the parts of the cars that didn't fail so that he could, you know, make them cheaper. But I'll take that as a flattery. Thanks.